ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
COVID first started to upend our lives 4 years ago, and for thousands of Australians, the effects of long COVID still linger, and they've been life-changing. I'm interested today in what symptoms you might experience, what forms of treatment you might encounter, especially what works, and also the policies our medical systems are using around long COVID, and perhaps how they compare to what's happening in other places. Are we getting the best treatment options possible in this country? And I'll need your help on this today on our talkback line. If you've experienced long COVID, how has it changed things for you? What has helped? And importantly, what's your experience been of the medical system? We're very lucky to have with us today Professor Stephen Foe. He's the co-founder of the Long COVID Centre at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney and the author of a book called Long COVID, Expert Advice from Diagnosis to Treatment and Recovery, which is such a key one, I think, for anyone suffering from long COVID to hear that that is a possibility and a probability. 1300 225 5576 is our talkback number if you're listening live on the radio on Eastern Time or anywhere at all on the app. 1300 225 5576. Professor Stephen Foe, welcome to Life Matters.
Oh, hi, Hilary. How are you going?
I'm well, thank you. Lucky me, you know, it seems like the luck of the draw if you've had COVID or been exposed to COVID. And it seems like there are still multiple theories about how and why some people develop long COVID and others don't. Do we have much hard evidence about those causes?
No, we don't. We've got a handful of hypotheses, but some of the latest research is sort of supportive of some of them already. One of the theories is that there's an increase in the amount of amyloid fibrin, which is a sticky sort of protein in your blood that might increase the risks of having clots. And we've seen a lot of people having blood clots in their chest or in their legs at the time of COVID. And in long COVID, we're finding quite a few people with undiagnosed blood clots in their chests. So one of the recent bits of research showed that this might be occurring in people's muscles as well and might be responsible for some of what we call the post-exercise symptom exacerbation, or where you do a bit of exercise and afterwards you're so exhausted that you can't do anything else for a little while. So I think little building blocks are now lining up for some of the theories, and I think we may find that we might be dealing with a variety of illnesses, or we might be dealing with one or two mechanisms for the illness that would then become targets for treatment.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? What is long COVID? Is it a group of symptoms that we've noted after infection that we just lump under this umbrella, or is it a clearly defined syndrome?
Well, that's a great question. It's not greatly defined. It's defined by the WHO as symptoms persisting for more than 3 months. And the symptoms need to have started after a COVID infection. And you can have fluctuations, but the symptoms need to last at least for 2 months or more. So that's the best we've got. It's a diagnosis of exclusion, which means you've got to exclude every other possible diagnosis, which is why general practitioners are really in the box seat, because most people will go to their GPs and say, you know, I don't seem to be coming right. Is there anything else going on? And for many people, there are simple explanations. It might be a diabetic presentation, or it might be that their blood pressure's not under under proper control. So we're hoping that a lot of it is easily addressed, but then there is a group of people for whom a diagnosis is completely evasive, and that sort of means it's related to COVID. And what you'll hear is people say that the symptoms they got with COVID seem to be coming or not, or, you know, or persisting.
Stephen, there's been some contention about the name itself, long COVID. Some researchers are saying, look, it's too similar to other post-viral illnesses. Let's call it something else. What's your view?
Well, I think it is different to other post-viral illnesses, firstly because of its onset and the fact that it was a worldwide pandemic. The second thing is that, yes, I think you're referring to the Queensland Chief Medical Officer who suggested we stop using the term because of a study that was conducted in Queensland where essentially I think they compared apples to oranges. They sort of compared people who had COVID, 90% of whom were vaccinated, to people who had influenza, only 40% who were vaccinated. So they found that the number of people who had influenza had long symptoms. About 3% of them had long symptoms compared to the number of people who had long symptoms from COVID. But you're more likely to have long symptoms if you don't, if you're not vaccinated. And in the study, you were not allowed to go in the study if you had any severe COVID, such as the one sending people to hospitals, which is, of course, one of the main risk factors for COVID. So it was a curious approach to public health to say, let's stop using the term. I just don't know how that sort of is a helpful thing to do in that setting.
It must have felt quite invalidating too for sufferers just to have someone say, oh, I don't think that's a thing.
Yeah, Hilary, I cannot tell you how many people we see in our long COVID clinic who have come to us through a series of episodes where they're being dismissed by medical people as if they don't, that they're questioning the veracity of their symptoms or they're suggesting that there is no such things. I think what happens initially when a new disease comes and doctors and health professionals have to learn about it is there's initial pushback because nobody wants to have to start studying a whole new area that they weren't trained in. But the numbers are mounting and the numbers of people walking into general practice with the same questions about their symptoms are mounting. So I think the tide is turning. And recently I spoke to general practitioners and they were very hungry for more information on it. So I think the future's bright in terms of the way it's going to be managed in general practice. But, it must feel awful for people to see that their medical practitioners, the people they depend on, seem to have no knowledge of it or are questioning whether they're, faking their symptoms. And for many people, that stays with them. They actually remember that for a very, very long time.
Yes, indeed. And I think questions, as you said, are mounting on our talkback line as well as people wanting to share their experiences with us, with the medical system and with the condition itself, long COVID. Lindsay's in Brunswick in Melbourne. Hello, Lindsay.
Hi, Hilary.
Hi. How did it change things for you?
Well, 10 weeks after my second dose of AstraZeneca in December 2020, I came down with, I think it must have been Delta, and immediately lost the sense of smell. I recovered from it then, but then my sense of smell was very damaged, and I didn't, for about 6 months, I didn't think my sense of smell was going to come back.
That must have been really distressing.
It was, yeah. I mean, I'd heard of that story about Michael Hutchins losing his sense of smell. A friend of mine had lost her sense of smell, falling over and hitting her head. And these are all things that were on my mind, thinking, is this going to be permanent, And so it went, gradually some sense was returning. But I was telling my doctor, my GP, I was saying, look, my sense of smell is gone. And they would just say, oh, that'll come back. That's pretty much all they would say.
Well, yes. And as we heard from Professor Stephen Foe, sometimes GPs lack the information and sometimes they lack the time and willingness to go find the information. Lindsay, did you find any other help elsewhere in the healthcare sector eventually, or did you just have to wait for things to improve?
I just waited for things to improve. I found out that it's called anosmia from the doctor. I think that's the term for this condition. I would just sort of count the victories as certain odours came back to me, But honestly, now coffee is a is a long distant memory of what that's not like.
Oh,
so,
no.
You know, and that's a wonderful thing.
I know, it sounds but, like yeah, such a little thing, doesn't it? But it's such a beautiful part of the day. Lindsay, thanks for illuminating that for us, because I think a lot of people might go, oh, yeah, loss of smell's not that bad, but it can really change the way you're experiencing the world, I think. Elizabeth's in the Macedon Ranges, also in Victoria, sharing her experience of long COVID. Elizabeth, welcome. You've had it for just over 2 years. What's changed for you in that time?
I get really emotional.
That's fine, it's a big thing.
You lose your life, basically. I mean, I'm 66. I've missed out on being a grandmother. I've missed out being a grandma. And just your life just changes dramatically. When you get up out of bed, you know, you're lying in bed and your heart rate's going about 70 or 80 beats a minute. Get out of bed and you stand in the kitchen and try to prepare a meal and your heart rate is going 160 beats a minute while your blood pressure's dropping to maybe about 80 over 50. So, you know, but for other people, you know, it may vary. They may stand up and their heart rate may drop dramatically and then rise dramatically.
It is such a variation between people, isn't it, Elizabeth?
Oh, it's just crazy. The best support for anybody out there that needs it is to go on Facebook, the Long COVID Australia group, and there you get people that really understand and can direct you. On there I found Clinic 19, which was a godsend because it was a doctor who really understand, and you could do it with telehealth so you didn't have to go anywhere. They gave me this diagnosis of POTS, and I think this would be fairly typical. When I did manage to get to the airport to try to visit my beautiful sisters in Queensland, and it was a huge thing for me to be doing. I had to sit down. I just got talking to the lady next to me and I said, oh yes, I have POTS from long COVID. And she turned to her husband and said, oh, you know, do you know about POTS? And he said, oh yes. He said, oh, but you don't get it from long COVID.
So some attitudes there that weren't particularly helpful. Elizabeth, how has going through the clinic changed things for you? Do you feel that recovery is happening in some way for you?
Well, I felt validated by them. I also had a functional GP because I was very lucky that I had a GP that just said, I don't know, go and find somebody who does. And I'd had the functional GP who did alternative things like vitamin therapy and stuff for me. But it's still a very long road. I have tried every alternative, acupuncture, herbal things, everything. And it's still, you know, as I once said to the doctor, I said, when I stand up out of bed, I feel like crying. I'm just a wuss. And she said, no, when you stand up, your body's telling you to lay back down before you pass out.
Yeah, it's that signal, isn't it, that your body's saying, I can't do this. But it's overlaid with a lot of, as you say, Elizabeth, stigma and reaction and a lot of complex symptoms. Our guest today is Professor Stephen Foe, the co-founder of the Long COVID Centre at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney. He's put a book out just now called Long COVID, Expert Advice from Diagnosis to Treatment and Recovery. Stephen, I just want to run a few things by you that Elizabeth and Lindsay raised. POTS, P-O-T-S. What's that and what is its relationship to long COVID?
Well, firstly, it's a variability in the heart rate. It's not always associated with hypotension or low blood pressure, but on standing, people get a rapid rise in their heart rate. I think it has to increase by more than 20 beats a minute. And you get a thumping in your chest, like palpitations. And of course, that sets off people's worries. You know, what's going on in my chest? And, you know, what does this mean? What we found, a very good piece of research done in the UK by Manoj Sivan, who is actually a rehabilitation physician coming to Sydney to speak, and there's going to be a public lecture on long COVID that he'll be giving as part of the International Rehabilitation Congress in Sydney. He did a study showing that 10% of people who present to long COVID clinics in the UK did have the diagnosis of POTS. And POTS is a disease that requires assessment by a cardiologist, and there are drugs that can actually change the variation in the heart rate. It's not always successful, but there are treatments and they do have positive effects. With respect to what Lindsay talked about, relates to the loss of smell, I think that's a much bigger deal than people make out. Certainly if you work in the food industry or you work as an emergency in the emergency industry, you need to be able to smell danger, smoke, etc. And also you need to smell wonderful foods, which is a great pleasure. And in fact, in the book, there's the story of one of the patients who ran an Indian restaurant who wasn't able to purchase fish anymore. So she had to get her husband to come and purchase the fish, and then she had to get her mother-in-law in to taste some of the food before it went out to the customers. There is a treatment for loss of smell. It's a rehabilitation treatment. It's spoken about in the book, where people try a series of oils and smells that are, there's a set that are actually described in the book. And you smell the smell, for instance, it might be lavender. And you have to imagine lavender, and you do that for about 10 to 15 seconds with a variety of other smells, and you do that every day, and over a matter of about 12 weeks, smell returns, because you can reignite the affected nerve cells in the brain by retraining them.
And it sounds like quite a specialised rehabilitation technique, and a lot of the people texting in and calling in have talked about the difficulty getting that kind of tailored, specialised help. Stephen, do we have enough clinics to meet the demand?
Well, I'm really glad you said that, because I, in my belief, there should be at least one or two specialised public clinics in each state. I think Elizabeth mentioned Clinic 19, which is a terrific clinic in Victoria, which is private, run by general practitioners with an interest, who I've heard speak, and they're impressive. I think then, you know, going to a general practitioner is not always easy. It's sometimes costly, and also if you see allied health people in the community, it's sometimes costly. So there needs to be a public access clinic for people. Also, we need to support general practitioners who are, you know, interested in the area with expert advice and contacts, so they can phone a friend if they need to. And we also need to develop centres of excellence so that we can do research. In my opinion, every state should have at least one or two of these multidisciplinary clinics.
I noticed, Stephen, that the federal government seems to be suggesting it's the states and territories' job to organise long COVID clinics. What's your view? Do you think it needs to have more central guidance?
Yeah, I think there's a fair bit of politics in COVID, and there always has been since it started. And with long COVID, there's also that it's opened up this old chestnut, which is the division of the funding of health between the states and the federal governments. And so the federal government feels it's a state responsibility. The state's asking for more money to support it because the numbers are very big. We imagine that there's somewhere between 500,000 and 1 million people who have at some stage been managing symptoms consistent with long COVID.
Half a million to a million now, yeah. And that's not counting the people who are being infected every month.
Yeah. That's right. Like there was 100,000 people infected in New South Wales with COVID in December of last year. Even if 1% of those become infected or affected by long COVID, that means there's another 1,000 people that are going to have to manage a disease that could last 2 years or three, even a bit longer. So I think Elizabeth, indicated that there really does need to be more support, and it starts with validation. And saying, look, this is real and this is a problem that we need to address. One of the reasons I've written the book is because the waiting list at our public clinic at St. Vincent's is almost 9 to 12 months. And I wanted to help people get the experience of coming to a clinic, or at least having more information while they're on the waiting list by writing this book.
Professor Stephen Foe is our guest, and the book is called, unsurprisingly, Long COVID: Expert Advice from Diagnosis to Treatment and Recovery. Really hoping to hear more of your experiences today on our Talkback line. Just quickly, Stephen, before we proceed to hear some more stories on Talkback, do we know why women seem to be experiencing long COVID at higher rates than men?
Yeah, it's again a great question. We're seeing at least 55% of women, and the other public clinic that's got data in New South Wales showing about 60 to 63%. One of the reasons is a psychosocial reason, which is that we put women in harm's way a lot in the caring professions. I mean, they do look after children, they do look after people sick in hospital, so their exposure rate would be higher. A second group in the US, suggested that because many of the women affected are in their 40s and on, that some of their symptoms might be perimenopausal and that we should think about that. But I think the most interesting theory is the one by an immunologist in the UK, Professor Akiko Iwasaki, she's the one who indicated that it was safe to use the vaccine in pregnancy. So she's got quite a high profile in the US. She suggested that women's immune system is trained to protect the unborn child, and as such, it sort of is very aggressive and fast onset at the beginning of an infection. And we actually found that more men died of COVID, of acute COVID, than women. So what she's saying is that the immune system fights the infection suddenly and very strongly in females, and then it sort of exhausts itself, so it can't keep fighting the infection 2 or 3 months down the track, where we think that there might be still reservoirs of the virus causing problems in the body. And whilst there's no, that's a hypothesis, it's sort of based on a lot of AI data looking at the immune responses of women during COVID.
Well, I can see why there are research gaps that you would like to see filled, because as we speak today, Stephen, it's clear that there's a lot of hypotheses, but we'd really like clarity, wouldn't we?
Oh, absolutely. I think we will get there. I mean, in the US, billions of dollars have been put into research, which is currently recruiting. In the UK, it's similar. In Australia, the federal government provided $50 million for research. Those grants were closed last year. They were due to be released awarded in April, but we're yet to hear.
Valerie is in Canberra. And Valerie, you've got a question for Stephen. Tell us about it.
I do. Look, I had a very similar experience to what people have been talking about. I couldn't get into a long COVID clinic. Luckily, through word of mouth, I found a GP who specialised in long COVID, and she's sort of set me up with a multidisciplinary team. But the thing that's really turned my life back around is the use of low-dose naltrexone. And I was wondering whether Stephen could say whether that is becoming a known treatment, or what his opinion on that is.
Great question, Valerie. Thank you. Stephen, what are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, firstly, I want to say I know your pain, because everyone who eventually gets seen in our clinic have been on the waiting list for a long time. So I wish that wasn't your experience. Naltrexone, they've done a couple of randomised controlled studies in the use of naltrexone for long COVID, and it hasn't really been shown to be of benefit. However, what a lot of people are doing is trying off-label uses of drugs. And what that means is if, for example, Ozempic, which people, your listeners might know about, is actually a drug for diabetes, but it's being used for weight reduction. So that's an example of a drug that we use that is off-label. So in the book, I've talked about how to actually design your own studies. And I'd suggest, Valerie, that you do that, that you spend around about, work out an outcome measure for you. It might be fatigue, and there's a measure that you can use, a very simple measure that's 7 questions. And you do that, and you stay on naltrexone for at least 3 weeks, do the measure again, then go off naltrexone for 3 weeks, do the measure again and then recommence naltrexone and then do the measure again in 3 weeks. And you will see very quickly whether this off-label use of naltrexone is actually working for you. It's a scientific approach and it helps save money because at the moment getting naltrexone is quite expensive. I don't know where you're getting it from, Valerie, but it's often compounding chemists that have to put it together and then there's quite a lot of labour costs. So, no one really knows if there's going to be a magic cure for it, but and everyone's trying off-label uses. In India, for instance, 94% of doctors have been trying off-label drugs to try and help people with long COVID in that country. So we expect people will do that, and it's just a matter of doing it in a way that helps you work out whether it's working or not.
So, Stephen, if people can't buy the book, is there access online to that measure of fatigue that you can use to run your own trial?
Yeah, absolutely. It's called the Fatigue Severity Scale, FSS, and you can get it online. Just Google it and it'll come up. It's a very simple measure. It's been validated. The best measure, the one that we use in our clinic, is called the Yorkshire C19 questionnaire. And it's a longer questionnaire, but it looks at every single system of the body because we know this virus affects every single system of the body. So we're using that for our research and also for our monitoring of improvements.
Fantastic. Thank you. And thanks to Valerie for that question. Margaret's in Caboolture in Queensland. Margaret, tell us how it's been for you since you were diagnosed in 2020.
Yes, in 2020, I actually wasn't diagnosed. My sister, a nurse, rang me and she said, you get straight to the hospital and get yourself checked out. So I came to Caboolture Hospital and they said, well, they don't do anything. And a doctor did check me, so she just wrote down that I had something about the symptoms I had, that I hadn't been overseas in the last 6 months. But before I got the COVID and then long COVID, I was very active, cruising a lot, getting around, very active, and then it just knocked everything out of me. Thankfully, my husband didn't get it at all. Well, that's only the two of us in the house here. But what I found at the beginning of the time, you'd sort of hear of people in hospital dying, so many dying. But I just knew all the time, like just a voice in my head was saying to me, don't lie down and sleep, stay sitting up. So I'd sit up to 21, 22 hours a day. And then if I did lay down, even for 15 minutes, then I'd wake up just gasping for air.
So, Margaret, the experience of having COVID sounds awful for you. A few years down the track, what kind of changes have you seen in your ability to live life to the fullest?
Oh, no, I can't. I'll just say to my husband, I've got to go sleep now, and I lie down the bed and go straight to sleep. The fatigue, the fog in your thinking often hits you too. It's attacked, probably attacked about 10 of my organs, I'd say. The doctor I had said he didn't believe in COVID or long COVID, and all I said to him, well, you've got a case here. But I didn't get help until 2 years later when I had a heart attack. Oh. And in hospital, they said to me, get yourself a decent doctor. We couldn't get any records from your doctor.
Right, and so there's a whole bunch of things going on there. Margaret, look, thank you and all the best for the future. It sounds like there's quite a long road for you, but I wish you all the best and thank you for your call. Jackie's in Coffs Harbour in New South Wales. 2 years of long COVID for you, Jackie. What's it been like?
It's actually been absolutely debilitating, and one of the things, as previously mentioned, is the lack of understanding or even recognition that I've come up against. I've got some good GPs, very nice people, but every time I've raised that question, do you think this could be related to my COVID infections? I've had multiple infections. I've actually had 4 officially and 5 unofficially, because in the end you know what it is and you just deal with it. And that's with having all the vaccines. It seemed to love me. But it's getting access in a regional rural area. Even I knew about Andrew's clinic in St. Vincent, but even trying to get access, because there was limited places. And so basically, it's rest, you know, they treat it like it's a flu symptom, you know, but it's not, or they send you to a psychologist. I've had to leave my job. I was a manager in disability services, which I've done for 30 years. But due to the fog, the fatigue, the muscle ache, and a whole range of other things, I've had to have a total lifestyle change. So my husband and I've turned 60, and my husband and I have actually sold our house, and we've moved down onto a bush block to try and get back to basics, but I'm still having all sorts of issues.
Yeah, and Jackie, some of the things you've raised there, other people are texting in about constantly here today on Life Matters as well, and calling the brain fog, the fatigue. Two interesting texts sitting side by side. One simply says, malingerers, and another says, I was 38 when infected and the healthiest I'd ever been in my life. It has ruined me. We're speaking with Professor Stephen Foe, who's the co-founder of the Long COVID Centre at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney. His new book's called Long COVID, Expert Advice from Diagnosis to Treatment and Recovery. Let's talk about a couple of the things raised in that last call, Stephen. The brain fog. Your clinic has included rehab techniques to address the effects on the brain. Tell us briefly what they involve.
Well, rehabilitation medicine is a part of medicine that trains people to live with any sort of disability. So we're very used to managing people who, say, have concussion or hit their heads or have had a stroke. So a lot of people describe brain fog, it's pretty similar to the cognitive problems that people have after they've hit their head or something like that. So what we do, firstly, is we exclude treatable things. So we'll do scanning of the brain and blood tests to exclude whether they've had strokes, because as Margaret raised, the number of people who have strokes and heart attacks in the first 12 months after COVID increases and is quite a lot higher than the general population. So I was sorry to hear that she had a heart attack, but I sort of wasn't surprised. So what we do is we exclude that. The next thing that we do is we try and characterise what it is that people are having problems with. Is it their memory? Is it their judgment? Is it their ability to concentrate and stay in focus? Is it problems dealing with two things happening at once, like cooking dinner and the phone going off? And then once we do that, we use occupational therapists and psychologists to sort of break down those tasks and then train people to do things, we call it chunking down. We train people to do the simplest part of the task in sequence so that they don't get overwhelmed by trying to do the whole thing at once. But probably one of the major roles that we have is contacting the workplace. We've found, like Jackie mentioned, we found that 25% of people who come to our clinics have either lost their jobs or quit. Lost their jobs, been sacked, or closed their businesses. For those still at work, we use our skills to contact the employer and make employers understand that people who have long COVID are going to take at least 6 months to return to their normal functioning, and that even though they're going to be normally functioning at work, they still might need to do things differently and they still might have symptoms. So what's been raised is particularly pertinent. And I guess the other thing is the person who texted you and said query malingerers, I think that is a response that people have when they don't know what's going on. This can't be real. It's a bit like denial that people suffer if they lose a partner or something like that. The first thing is you just can't believe it's happening, so this can't be right. But if we're going to get a handle on it, we have to sort of move beyond that and say, well, there's all these hundreds of thousands of people with it in Australia. We really can't say they're all malingerers. And I've never seen anyone come in wanting to lose their job and lose money for the purpose of being able to complain.
And that enjoyment of life. Elizabeth was saying, I've missed out on being a grandmother, which you can't get back those years, can you? Yeah. We're speaking about long COVID and the effects it has on people's lives. Stephen, there's a section in your book about pacing, gradually building up your tolerance to exercise. And some people will be a bit wary of that idea, having pushed themselves too far in the past. How can people make sure that they're doing it gently enough?
Yeah, well, that's very good. Very good question. I mean, one of the things is that you need to be able to do three things if you're going to pace. One of them is you're going to need to analyse the things you do and attribute how much energy you expend with that. So walking your kids to school, that might take a certain amount of energy, but going on a 10-kilometre run, that might be a bit different. So once you do that, then you have to set your priorities. And a lot of people have a lot of difficulty here. You know, what's more important, walking the kids to school or going for a 10-kilometre run? What's more important for your quality of life? And then once you do that, then you have to sort of order your day so that you're doing the things that you prioritise when you've got a lot more energy. There are some people who can do that quite well. There are other people who perhaps might have a lot more responsibilities or feel their responsibilities very strongly, who'll have difficulty accepting that and understanding that. And we see a lot of those people in our clinics. They're people who are high achievers, who are proud of the things that they achieve, proud of their families, proud of the way that they manage as a father or a mother. And to ask those people then to reorganise themselves often causes mental anguish and sometimes actually leads to anxiety and breakdown in some of their mental health. And so we use psychologists and occupational therapists to validate it, say, look, you're going to have to do this because it's not going to go away straight away. And we also get them used to doing it by starting it in a slow way. So the book has a few examples, but I must say I feel a bit clumsy giving examples about pacing. We have fantastic allied health people, psychologists, occupational therapists, physios, who just do this all the time. And I put a part in the book saying, listen, I'm not an allied health person. I know what they do, but they've got great skills in intuition and training that really need to be, be accessed.
And as you said, need to be more widely available. We'll have to finish this discussion today. We could clearly go on for quite some time, given the number of calls and the variety of stories coming through. But Professor Stephen Foe, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your expertise with us on Life Matters today.
Thanks, Hilary. Thanks for thinking this is an important issue to discuss.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Professor Stephen Foe is the co-founder of the Long COVID Centre at St Vincent's Hospital, Sydney. His book's called Long COVID, Expert Advice from Diagnosis to Treatment and Recovery.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.